like-minded Iowans. She is a person that is driven by what people tell her, and that is like ammunition for her to talk about the things she wants to talk about, the aide said. Hillary also bypassed the national media to communicate with Iowans through local outlets, as much because it signaled that she cared about Iowa as for any influence the hometown papers and broadcast stations might have with their readers, listeners, and viewers. The strategy, from our perspective, was that you're dealing with an electorate that is highly plugged into whatever the outlet is, said one aide. So while the national media does drive a fair amount of the narrative conversation, it was really important that people be seeing her talk to the local affiliate in Des Moines, talk to the Des Moines Register for an hour. The summer months of 2015 were as punishing for Hillary in Iowa as they were nationwide. Sanders kept building a force for what he called a political revolution, and Hillary kept trying every possible route to get out from under the weight of her email scandal. Every route except apologizing. By August, Bernie was catching up to her, and her team decided without much dissent to begin airing two positive ads. There was an inherent long-term cost to that. Once she started running expensive spots, she couldn't stop until caucus night, or it would be pointed to as a sign that she was pulling up stakes. But she had to do something to arrest Sanders' surge. Both ads featured her late mother, Dorothy Rodham, and framed Hillary's candidacy around fighting for children and families. At the time, Hillary's aides believed she needed to fill in a vacuum for voters. They hadn't yet heard her motivation for running. There wasn't a real clear sense of why she was in it. Minus that, people want to assign their own motivations, at the very best, a politician who thinks it's her turn, one campaign staffer said. It was true and earnest, but it was also received well. We were talking to Democrats, who largely didn't think she was evil. The ads were perceived mostly on the level of Hillary embracing her gender through her mother, but there was an underlying theme that played well in focus groups and pointed to an area where Hillary might be able to persuade voters with positive messages about herself. One of the ads went deep into Dorothy's background as a child sent away by her parents to live with grandparents who didn't want her. And the role models who helped turn her life around with lessons of compassion and love. Dorothy was a fighter, and so, the ad said, was Hillary. At the end of the spot, Hillary says she is running for all of the Dorothys out there who need a champion. Voters liked her strength, resilience, and take-no-shit attitude, said a person familiar with focus group data. Hillary's decision to go up on the air forced Bernie to reconsider his own strategy. In Washington, Devine showed the two new Hillary ads to Bernie and Weaver. They were good, all agreed. What do you think we should do? Bernie asked. I don't think we can play their game, Devine replied. First of all, it would play into Hillary's hands for Bernie to start draining his treasury to keep up with her. Second, because Bernie was averse to conducting opinion research, his campaign wasn't really ready to put together a high-end political spot. They chose to stay the course. We didn't freak out and join them and waste money doing stuff that we weren't ready to do, one Bernie ally said, adding that it worked for us. But Hillary's ads helped stabilize her in polling. That ultimately was a key decision, because it gave us a reset moment after what was a brutal summer, said one top Clinton advisor. All the while, her Iowa operatives, led by Paul, focused on wrapping up the support of every possible institutional player in the state. The idea was to prevent Sanders from putting together the ground troops and political infrastructure to match the energy pumped into his campaign from activists and students. Rather than just court the typical high-level endorsers and surrogates, they went deeper into the roster of elected officials. In particular, They targeted young women who had been elected to office, like North Liberty Mayor Amy Nielsen, who went on to win a state House seat in 2016. Having a younger cohort among her retinue of older elected officials would show Iowans that her campaign wasn't just for the Medicare-eligible set that tilted heavily in her direction. On the ground, things began to look up toward the end of the summer, and Hillary seized control of the Iowa race again in that magical October on the strength of her performance in the first debate and the Benghazi hearings. With Joe Biden no longer a factor and Martin O'Malley unable to find traction, Hillary seemed to have a powerful upper hand through November and early December. But everything went sideways in mid-December. Thinking Iowans would be tuned out of the political race during the holidays, Hillary eased up on the gas. At the same time, Sanders finally blitzed the airwaves with television and radio spots. "We made a calculation that people would be sort of checked out over Christmas and come back over the new year," a member of her team confided. That was a mistake to give him that room. Hillary's internal analytics survey numbers showed a nearly 10-point swing toward Bernie in December. Improbably, Sanders, the iconoclastic old socialist with the wild hair, windmill arms, and willful disregard for convention, had surpassed her in New Hampshire and was starting to pull away there. Hillary's advantage in Iowa, which bounced as high as 32 points at the end of October, had fallen into single-digit territory. And in some of the public polls, Sanders was the one ahead by a few points. Her national lead, which had also re-expanded in October and November, would soon wither again. "Our numbers tightened," said a source involved in Hillary's Iowa operation. "We knew New Hampshire was a buzzsaw, so we knew the pressure that was on us." It was inexplicable to Hillary's team, except to say that Bernie had tapped into the mood of the electorate and Iowans finally started to make serious assessments about the candidates between Thanksgiving and Christmas. If Hillary had relaxed a bit when Biden chose not to run, and she had, now she was very much on edge. She didn't like what she was seeing or what she was reading in the newspaper, and she had run short on patience with her campaign manager. Over the holidays, as her numbers slid, Hillary lit up Mook's phone. She wanted to know what the hell was happening and what he was going to do to fix it. The overall picture had slipped from optimistic to worrisome to alarming. The campaign manager tried to reassure her. "We don't need Iowa to win the nomination," he said, reminding her that his original conservative projections had her losing the caucuses. "It would be great to win, especially to take the state by a big margin," he said. "But everything will be fine if Bernie manages to prevail." From a purely mathematical standpoint, that was true. Bernie wouldn't net a lot of delegates, no matter the outcome. But Iowa was the first state in the race, and it could act as a springboard for him. Secondarily, pride was on the line for Hillary in a state that had rejected her before. The decision to compete there, and thus to keep Iowa in the spotlight, had long since been made. Mook had put a lot of the campaign's eggs in the Iowa basket, knowing that it took a long time and a lot of resources to run a months-long race there. Now that Hillary was in danger of losing, that decision would either turn out to show prescience in shoring her up, or foolhardiness in wasting resources. Bernie's big lead in New Hampshire magnified the hero or goat nature of the Iowa outcome for Mook. And back-to-back Bernie wins in the first two states on the calendar had the potential to give Bernie unstoppable momentum. Bill Clinton was the only candidate in either party in the previous four decades to lose both states and come back to win a nomination. Still, Iowa was way too close for comfort. In addition, Both Clintons had been hearing a lot of grumbling from within the party and within the campaign about Mook's neglect of the rest of the state contests. If Hillary lost Iowa, a double hit could be coming because Mook hadn't deployed enough resources to be certain Hillary could hold off Sanders after New Hampshire. The calendar was teed up for him to do some serious damage to us early, said one longtime Clinton hand. Mook called an early January meeting with the rest of the campaign's top brass to talk about Iowa. Podesta, Paul, Palmieri, Marlon Marshall, Michael Halley, and a few others. Some of them dialed in to what was a decidedly sober meeting at the campaign headquarters in Brooklyn. Channeling Hillary from their earlier discussions, Mook wanted to see if there was anything the campaign needed to do in terms of advertising, field organizing, and targeting caucus-goers. It was like, okay, this is getting tight, one participant in the meeting said. Are we doing everything we can right now? Or what else do we need to do? From getting more surrogates in the state, looking at our targeting, expanding the universe of people we're talking to. With Hillary's operation running at full steam again, Bernie hit a plateau. He leveled out in Hillary's internal numbers, leaving the two candidates roughly even with just a few weeks until caucus day. The month of December was brutal, recalled one aide involved in trying to ensure Hillary's ground game would carry her past Bernie. Because the caucuses would be a referendum on the front runner, and because Bernie had all the energy, the trick wasn't to convert Sanders people into Clinton backers. Already, Hillary's aides believed it was hard to change attitudes toward her. Trying to do so would take too much expensive persuasion and would likely fall short anyway. Instead, the challenge for Hillary's team was turning out the targeted number of people who would caucus for her, not just statewide, but in each precinct. Throughout the campaign, Mook would give short shrift to persuasion efforts, a bias that either reflected a savvy understanding of the electorate or a costly miscalculation of Hillary's capacity for building a broader coalition. In Iowa, the only focus was on winning delegates to the state Democratic convention, a math exercise that didn't necessarily require Hillary to win more total votes, but to take a majority in the right set of caucus sites. In all, that meant having nearly 2,000 precinct chairs hitting their targets, which could come either from already identified Clinton backers or, potentially, from finding new people who were inclined to support her. Outwardly, Mook wasn't in a state of panic, but he was serious, and he knew Iowa was much more fertile ground for corn than it was for Clinton's. Mook and Marlon Marshall, the state's director, stayed in close contact with the campaign's Iowa field team for the final 3 weeks, trying to figure out how to best allocate resources to win at caucus sites across the state. Mook's equanimity was one of the reasons he was chosen to run the campaign, but everyone in the operation was a little rattled, including the Clintons. Hillary's communications shop wanted to more aggressively attack Sanders to drive his numbers down, an instinct in line with the Clinton way of handling foes, while senior strategists knowingly advised that she would hurt herself by going after a popular figure who hadn't been negative enough to warrant return volleys. It was the latest round in a running debate over how to handle the rise of Sanders. Bill and Hillary had wanted to put him down like a junkyard dog early on. She'd let him get too far without a punch already, she thought. Instinctively, the Clintons wanted to pound on rivals, whether campaign opponents, congressional Republicans, prosecutors, or women who had accused Bill of sexual misconduct. But it hadn't always proved to be the most effective strategy. Hillary had hammered away at Obama in 2008, and it had boomeranged. The paradigm was similar with Bernie. Her negatives were high, and he was well-liked. On the advice of her campaign counselors, Hillary largely restrained herself. The problem, her close confidants knew, was that if they gave her an inch to attack Sanders, she'd take a mile. So on July 12th, a day after Joe Biden had praised Sanders's authenticity on the issue of income inequality and said it was relatively new for Hillary to talk about it, Chelsea Clinton lit into Sanders as she stumped for her mother in New Hampshire. It was odd for the candidate's daughter to become the vehicle for an attack, but the Clintons were spoiling for a fight. It was better that a charge come from someone other than the candidate, so that Chelsea's words could be embraced or rejected by Hillary, depending on how they played. Senator Sanders wants to dismantle Obamacare, dismantle the CHIP program, dismantle Medicare, and dismantle private insurance, Chelsea said of Sanders's Medicare for All health care plan. I don't want to empower Republican governors to take away Medicaid, to take away health insurance for low-income and middle-income working Americans. And I think very much that's what Senator Sanders' plan would do. Across the Democratic universe, and particularly in Sanders' camp, the dusting off of the Clintons' scorched earth playbook was taken as a sign of desperation, and accurately so. I was surprised and thought it was out of character, Arizona Congressman Raul Grijalva told the Hill newspaper. It seems the Clinton campaign is going into full destruction mode very early in this process. The fact-checking website PolitiFact instantly rated Chelsea's claim as mostly false. The attack previewed an angle Hillary would take, that Sanders was so liberal he rejected Obama's legacy. But it gave Sanders and his allies a perfect opening to stab Hillary back. When he was asked about it, Sanders smiled and replied, "As much as I admire Chelsea, she didn't read the plan." The episode reinforced the idea that Clinton was running scared. It reminded Democrats that Hillary would go negative and do it dishonestly, and she had turned to her daughter to defend her. The Clinton campaign insisted that it was an unplanned moment. But when Bill Clinton did the same thing a week later, also in New Hampshire, it was pretty clear that the Clinton family still didn't believe that the risk of a low-approval candidate attacking a well-liked one outweighed the prospective gain of drawing blood. The candidate herself remained a little more precise in her messaging. She delivered rebukes to Sanders over health care in a January 17th debate in Charleston, South Carolina, that were part of a much more powerful message than portraying Sanders as naive. While some analysts rated the debate a victory for Sanders, Clinton reinforced the architecture of her southern firewall by tying herself to Obama and charging that Sanders would undo the good work of the president's administration, echoing what Chelsea and Bill had said on the trail. "We have the Affordable Care Act. That is one of the greatest accomplishments of President Obama, the Democratic Party, and of our country," Clinton said. "To tear it up and start over again, pushing our country back into that kind of a contentious debate, I think is the wrong direction." Her approach was a gentle but clear contrast, rather than a gut punch. No fewer than 5 public polls began testing Clinton and Sanders in Iowa the day after the debate. Clinton led by 9 points in 2 of them and by 6 points in 1 of them, but she trailed by 4 points in a 4th and a single point in the 5th. Taken together, they showed that Bernie was in striking distance. Inside the Clinton campaign, the trend line looked ghastly. For months, Bernie had slowly built his surge. Now, with caucus day quickly approaching, his movement was gathering strength and velocity. It was viral and exciting, palpable on the ground and in the polls. He'd blitzed Hillary in December, taking her team by surprise, and now he was positioned to sack her. As Iowans took their last measure of the two candidates, what stood out was Bernie's energy and Hillary's dishonesty. Everything was breaking Bernie's way, and the question was whether Hillary's superior operation could withstand the crush of support for him. Where we saw a big dip was about 10 days out, one Clinton aide said of the campaign's internal polling. In one instance, we lost 7 points in the matter of a week. We knew this was going to be close. We knew that his positives were going up and our negatives were going up. And just based on what we were hearing, based on the numbers we were getting back, we knew, if you will, that the struggle was very real. Some of Mook's internal critics began rattling their sabers, setting the expectation that if Hillary lost Iowa, his job, or at least his influence, would evaporate. He hadn't predicted a win in Iowa in his early projections, and he had poured resources into the state anyway. There had been little choice. Hillary couldn't afford not to compete there at all, and once she started campaigning there, a loss would be taken by the media, her donors and supporters, and Sanders's donors and supporters as a major blow to her campaign. Hillary knew from experience that money would dry up if she started losing, and that it could be hard to stop a moving progressive train as it gathered steam. Moreover, because she was getting clobbered in New Hampshire, and because Nevada was close, a defeat in Iowa could quickly turn into a three-state slide. And then, in quick succession, Hillary received two blessings from the Des Moines Register. The first was the paper's endorsement. It was hardly an assurance of victory, but the editorial was firm in its conclusion that Sanders' platform was pie in the sky. A successful Sanders presidency would hinge on his ability to remake Washington in his own image, the Register wrote. It's almost inconceivable that such a transformation could take place, even with Democrats controlling both chambers of Congress. 5 days later, and 2 days before the caucuses, she got the second blessing, the final in a series of Register polls conducted in conjunction with Bloomberg Politics, showed her with a 3-point lead. That tracked very closely to the campaign's analytics-driven expectations, which gave her a 4-point edge, 47% to 43%. In theory, she would take the caucuses with a close but comfortable margin. For all the obstacles Hillary faced in Iowa, her email scandal, the anti-war and anti-Wall Street tilt of the caucus electorate, Sanders's surge in popularity, and the Clintons' poor track record in the state, she went into caucus day expecting to win. Coming in first mattered for two reasons. A victory might break the Sanders fever in the Democratic Party, and it would reassure her own panicky donors and supporters. By this point, she knew she was in deep trouble in New Hampshire, which magnified the importance of getting that first tally on the board. There was some sense it was going to be close, but not that it was going to be asshole-puckering close, said one of her senior advisors. On caucus day, the Clinton High Command was split between two locations, the Savory Hotel downtown, where Bill's voice rattled the walls, and the campaign's Iowa headquarters nearby. The latter spot was dubbed the Boiler Room by its denizens, a nod to the pressure cooker nature of running numbers on an election night. Hillary's team had estimated that there would be a lot of new registrants, people who signed up on the day of the caucuses, and that they would break for Bernie 75% to 25%, or as much as 80% to 20%. All night, they fielded reports from precinct captains across the state. They had designed a special app to collect the results, and the data came in a bit faster than the tallies viewers could see on the television screens in their homes. As Hillary's lead on Sanders narrowed, a function of the closeness of the race overall and the order in which caucus sites reported, dread gnawed away the optimism that had marked the start of the day. It was very tense, said one source in the boiler room. As the numbers came in, it became clear that, whoever won, the margin was going to be almost nothing. For all intents and purposes, it would be a draw. But both campaigns and the national media knew that someone would be declared the winner. If Hillary lost, she'd have to fight stories of an epic failure. If she won, she would have survived the Sanders surge. The boiler room kept in touch with the crew at the Savory Hotel, though the communication was interrupted because Paul had forgotten his phone charger. He had to borrow one from veteran Clinton media consultant Mandy Grunwald to keep the lines open. Reading the data in the boiler room, members of the analytics team were surprised by the reports on new registrants. The overall number was a little more than they had expected. But they had also underestimated the margins for Bernie. The first-timers were breaking 90% to 10% in his favor. Running the data through their models, they could see why the race was so tight. That was what plugged into a fraction of a point versus 1.5, 2 points, said one of Hillary's top Iowa specialists. But it still wasn't enough, they calculated, for Bernie to eclipse Hillary's lead. The race was too close for the Associated Press or the broadcast networks to make a call. But the analytics and field operatives reported to Mook that the slowly evaporating lead wouldn't disappear altogether. We were confident that we had it, the aide said. Hillary's get-out-the-vote team on the ground, bolstered by a handful of talented veteran organizers, had been built with the expectation that Bernie wouldn't do as well as he did. They overperformed, and their work had bailed out the analytics squad. That was good news in that Hillary had eluded defeat, but the outcome served to obscure flaws in Elon Kriegel's modeling, namely that it hadn't correctly accounted for the number of new registrants or the degree to which they would break for Hillary, and Mook's corresponding allocation of resources for in-person contact with caucus-goers. The seeds of what we see across the campaign were present there, said one person familiar with the campaign's strategy and tactics. It was a warning sign that they just barely scraped by, and I don't think they took that seriously. The question, as numbers continued to trickle in on caucus night, was whether Hillary could or should declare herself the winner, if there was even a sliver of a chance of the overall outcome flipping. Not only would it have been an embarrassment to be wrong, but it would have reinforced the narrative that Hillary's word couldn't be trusted. At the same time, she couldn't afford to let Sanders call himself the winner to a national television audience first. Soon after Anzalone warned that the numbers might not hold, Hillary appeared in the doorway and leaned against the jamb. It was her second trip down the hall from her room to the strategist's bullpen. The first time she'd been cheerful and optimistic. Now she was anxious inside, with an all-business exterior. The change in demeanor was palpable, and it brought everyone to attention. With her fate in Iowa hanging in the balance, she asked for guidance. Should she go out and claim victory? And if so, when? Or should she give a more anodyne statement because the results were still trickling in? It wasn't just a question of whether she would win, but how she should spin this split decision from Iowa caucus-goers. Hillary had a preference, but she wanted to get everyone on board before making the call. All right, guys, now this is serious. What are we doing? She asked, obviously impatient and leading her witnesses. Am I going to give this speech or am I going to wait? Palmieri argued that whatever the content, it was essential that Hillary speak before Sanders. Hillary should get on the road to her rally at Drake University as soon as possible. Bill Clinton thought Hillary should tell Iowans and the nation that she would be declared the winner, and he said as much. Mook, who had arrived from the campaign's boiler room, told Hillary that the final result would fall somewhere between losing by 0.2 percentage point and winning by 0.2 percentage point. But, he said, she was likely to be the victor. He advocated that her aides call her the winner, without the words passing her own lips. It was that close. Hillary went with Mook's recommendation, a vote of confidence for her embattled campaign manager. "Give us 5 minutes," Podesta said of the need to fashion a speech that hinted at victory without declaring it. "We'll figure it out and split the baby." A winter storm was quickly approaching Des Moines, and Hillary needed to get on a plane to be in New Hampshire for a week-long sprint through the first primary state. The next morning would be too late. Flights out of Des Moines, packed full of national reporters, campaign operatives, and senators who had come to stump for various Democratic and Republican candidates, would be delayed or canceled. "Let's go," Hillary prodded. "Get in the cars." During those same hours, Bernie and his team lived through a mirror image scenario. Weaver and Devine were at the campaign's Iowa headquarters when the team's data analysts saw an improvement in Bernie's chances of winning. The first exit polls had shown him down nearly 10 points, but actual returns were coming in better. He was gaining on Hillary. And the number crunchers started projecting that the outcome would be very close. Weaver and Devine hightailed it to Bernie's hotel room to watch the returns come in and to strategize with their candidate. The numbers kept getting better and better as they watched television with Bernie and his family. It was becoming clear that it would be hard for the media to declare a winner anytime soon. But, like Clinton, Bernie had to get out of town before the coming storm. He motioned to Devine to join him in the bedroom. Bernie lay down as his strategist paced the room. What, if anything, should he say before he took off for New Hampshire? Devine laid out the challenge. "Say, thank you, Iowa," he said, explaining, "if we declare victory while she's a little ahead, we're going to look like jerks. Let them declare victory so they can look like jerks." As Bernie scribbled the words onto a yellow legal pad, Devine explained how they could work to excite his base without putting him in the position of falsely calling himself the winner if he ended up losing. "Thank you, Iowa. That's what you say when you win," Devine said. "But you're not really declaring victory." Bernie got it. He kept writing as Devine dictated the next line. "It looks like tonight we have a tie in Iowa," Devine started. "No," Bernie interjected, taking his pen from the page. "A virtual tie." When they'd written a single paragraph, Devine told Bernie that was enough new material. "Go into your stump speech," he said, and then, "Let's get the hell out of town." Dan Schwerin rewrote Hillary's speech as she and her team piled into a motorcade and made what felt like an hour-long trip to the Drake University campus 5 minutes away. As he tapped out edits to her remarks, he strained to hear above the deafening sirens from Clinton's police escorts. In the end, she didn't use his words. She scrapped the prepared text and spoke extemporaneously. Wearing a dramatic red that matched the shade of the forward-pointing arrow in her campaign logo, she expressed a sentiment that would come to define not only the result in Iowa, but her long slog to the nomination. While the campaign had war-gamed various possible scenarios in regard to that evening's outcome, they never predicted this roller coaster ending. On stage that night, Hillary was, she said, breathing a big sigh of relief. Matt Paul, who rode in the motorcade to Drake, believed he'd done everything he could have for Hillary. The caucuses were a test of Sanders's message and momentum against Hillary's superior organization. He had spoken to Hillary and Bill countless times about that question. Could Sanders win purely on energy and enthusiasm? In the final several weeks, Sanders' campaign began to build the infrastructure to match the sentiment that had captured the hearts of liberal, young, and politically unaffiliated Iowans. To counter Sanders, the Clinton team focused on making sure that every ally heard from a top campaign official 5 or 6 times over the course of the caucus season, and on training precinct captains to master the intricacies of the complex caucus process. Had we not had every single organizer that we had, had we not reached out to every possible group or every newly elected person or every advocacy community, we would have lost, said one Clinton advisor. The current was that strong against us. At the end, it was all that muscle. Mook's field operation had been just strong enough to withstand Bernie, but not by the margin his analytics team had predicted, and not by enough to quiet his critics. He was flying very close to the sun. As Hillary spoke, Paul huddled backstage with her national campaign team to say his goodbyes. He heard some of the speech, but not all of it. Like everyone else, he was disappointed by the numbers on the scoreboard. And when she appeared backstage with Bill on her way out of town, Paul told her as much. "I wish it would have been more," he told the couple. "Don't let anybody ever tell you that she didn't win," Bill said. "In August, I was certain we were going to lose," Hillary said. Chapter 8. The Prize and the Pain. Less than a year before the Iowa caucuses, in April 2015, Hillary had flown to New Hampshire to meet with 24 old friends at former State Senate President Sylvia Larson's home in Concord. As a steady rain came down outside, Hillary, sitting in an easy chair in an art-filled living room with a grand piano, listened to the long-time residents share what was on their minds and how they thought she might carry the primary there. She was focused on substance and policy, but Terry Shoemaker, an old Clinton friend who had served as ambassador to Trinidad during Bill's administration, thought there was something missing from the conversation. The personal piece. "Everybody knows who you are, but nobody knows who you are," Shoemaker told her. He loved her, and he thought others would feel the same if they knew her the way that he did. Her friends found her generous, thoughtful, and funny in person, but that seldom translated in front of strangers or at campaign events. It was a problem that had dogged her throughout her public life, and it would bedevil her again if she didn't open up more. "People don't know what makes you tick," Shoemaker said. It was ironic that a woman who had been on the national stage for a quarter of a century, who had lived the triumphs of victory and the tragedies of defeat and humiliation in public, could still seem inaccessible to so many Americans, even to her supporters. But Shoemaker, who had plenty of Republican friends and knew a lot of Democrats who weren't Hillary fans, understood that one reason people thought she lacked honesty is that they had watched her for so long and felt like they had seen so little of her. She'd been stung before, though, when she spoke from the heart. She was ridiculed during the 1992 campaign for saying she wouldn't stay home and bake cookies, for separating herself from women who would stand by their man no matter what, and later for arguing that she and her husband were the victims of a vast right-wing conspiracy. She'd suffered the backlash of talking about her values openly over the years. That had hardened the thick shell of someone who was intensely private by nature. Shoemaker believed the trait that best defined Hillary was her indomitability, and he thought others would appreciate hearing more about that. Back in 1999, he met with her in the White House and inquired about the rumors that she might run for the Senate. "Yeah, I'm thinking about it," she said coyly. "Come on," he chided. "It's me." "Yeah, I'm going to do it," Hillary confided. Are you sure the prize is worth the pain? Shoemaker asked. Hillary smiled as she turned her palms upward. What else can they do to me? She asked. Shoemaker knew where Hillary had acquired this attitude, from her mother, Dorothy Rodham. As New Hampshire chairman of Bill Clinton's two presidential campaigns, he had gotten to know Dorothy and her story. Shoemaker had always wanted Hillary to explain to voters how her mother's resilience had formed her own character. But he usually found his friend to be surprisingly resistant to talking about Dorothy. It was hard for him to understand. Candidates often opened up about their parents' influence as a way of putting context around their values. That was harder for Hillary, who struggled with the fear of leveraging her mother's tough upbringing for political gain. Hillary had written about her mother's perseverance in the 1996 book, It Takes a Village, but she wasn't on the campaign trail then. Dorothy Rodham died in November 2011, and with her passing and the passage of time, Hillary felt less reluctance to make her part of this campaign story. When Shoemaker attended an early campaign event at an Exeter bookstore and heard Hillary detailing her mother's hardships, he thought she should do more of it. That was wonderful, Shoemaker told her as they browsed the bookshelves after the event. You can't talk too much about your mother. Nobody knows this stuff. I never wanted to talk about her while she was alive. I thought it was exploitative, she said. It's still difficult for me to do. But it was part and parcel of her strategy for 2016 all the same. On Mother's Day in 2014, an early excerpt of her book, Hard Choices, appeared in Vogue. The section, which had little to do with the rest of the book's focus on Hillary's work as a diplomat, presaged how the campaign would use her late mother to explain, in human terms, why Hillary was almost inhumanly tough, internally and externally. And in August 2015, Hillary's first two ads of the campaign featured Dorothy. That piece of Hillary's narrative dovetailed with her frequent talk of her daughter and granddaughter on the campaign trail. 8 years after she'd tried so hard not to talk about her gender, the references to the women in her family were a low-risk way of reminding voters about it in this election. But as the months wore on, it didn't seem to matter much how Hillary packaged herself to New Hampshire voters. When Sanders began to catch up to Hillary in Iowa in the late fall and early winter, he also surged way ahead in New Hampshire. The scary thing for Clinton's team, which was led on the ground by Mike Vlasic, a Queens, New York-born, New Hampshire-educated campaign rat, was that she was getting pummeled, even though her favorable ratings among Democrats were in the high 70s and low 80s. After he started putting a little bit of money into the state, Sanders's favorability rating reached into the mid-90s in the Clinton campaign's polling, something none of her operatives had ever seen before. Everyone in New Hampshire was feeling the burn, even those who planned to vote for Hillary. Sanders's negative ratings were about the size of the margin of error. Vlasic, who had a prominent cleft in his chin and was topped by a crop of thick black hair, could sense an earthquake within the local electorate that would wipe out the basic rules of campaign politics. Even if the internal polls had shown Hillary leading by a few points, he argued to his colleagues, the trends were going in the wrong direction, and fast. He could feel the cold earth shifting beneath his feet. Sanders was running away with it, and no one could stop him. At one point before the Iowa caucuses, Benenson had shown a positive clip of Martin O'Malley to a focus group in Londonderry, New Hampshire, and the response to it was negative. Bernie's surge led to some testy moments for the Clinton team. Vlasic got peppered with questions about what could be done to reverse the trend. The obvious answer? Go negative on Sanders. But the consensus, as in Iowa, was that it wouldn't work. Blasich did want more money to help Hillary. He believed the campaign had to compete hard to prevent a complete wipeout. He had a series of what one source described as heart-to-hearts with Mook over the budget. It was Vlasic's role to ask for more, and it was Mook's place to say no. There wouldn't be extra money for a state where Hillary had virtually zero chance of winning. In successive polls released before the Iowa caucuses, Sanders expanded his lead in New Hampshire to between 20 points and 31 points. Hillary was headed for a shellacking, and there was a reasonable argument that she shouldn't invest much time, energy, or money in New Hampshire. Aboard the jet in the wee hours of Tuesday, February 2nd, 2016, the Iowa caucus result didn't feel like a victory at all. Sullivan, one of several aides huddled around Hillary, encapsulated the agony for his colleagues. "Literally, only the Clinton campaign can win, get the Iowa monkey off its back, and it's like, it sucks," he said. "That is our lot in life." That lot was about to get a lot worse. Hillary was already past it, poring over the New Hampshire polling and the composition of the electorate. None of what she was seeing or hearing from her aides was pretty. She was in a deep hole, and Mook didn't think she could climb out of it. He wanted her to spend as little time and money as possible in New Hampshire. "Ditch it," he said. "Go twice and focus on Nevada." Hillary pushed back. "I don't like giving up on states, and I don't think it's the right thing to do," she told her aides as the small plane flew east through the night sky. There was another, more important reason to go all out on the hustings in the Granite State. "We cannot write off New Hampshire," she said. "This is a state that we need in the general," she reminded. So Hillary braced herself to campaign in this last week like she had a shot at winning. She knew she was much more likely to lose than win, but she hadn't completely ruled out a miracle. She'd pulled one out in 2008 in New Hampshire, and the state had revitalized Bill in 1992. He didn't want her to skip it either. "There was a belief that they could come back," said one senior aide who talked to both Clintons. "Talk about data-driven versus gut-driven. There was just sort of a mystical thing around New Hampshire." New Hampshire may have been mystical, but the campaign was decidedly earthbound. By the time she touched down in New Hampshire after the Iowa caucuses, the rumor mill was fast at work about a massive campaign shakeup, the kind of desperate move that would rattle the confidence of supporters and donors and telegraph to the media that Clinton's campaign was in real trouble. From Hillary's point of view, they were failing her. They hadn't anticipated the rise of Bernie. They hadn't been able to create a message to break through the email scandal, and they had just barely, by the skin of their teeth, run Iowa well enough to win. She was going to make changes, big changes, but they would have to wait. Mook had the most reason to be nervous about his job. Longtime Clinton confidants outside the campaign had been agitating for months for Hillary to get rid of him. She had heard from allies across the states that Mook wasn't building the campaign's ground game enough for an all-out war against Sanders. He'd focused too much on the first four states, and even the operatives there felt under-resourced. His penny-pinching was becoming a real issue across the country. In addition, veteran Democratic hands found him to be secretive, a problem that was flagged by Podesta and other power brokers in the Brooklyn headquarters, Clinton allies in Washington, and top political operatives in the states. He'd created an insular and loyal staff below him, but he'd been predictably unable to control the cross-cutting circles of Clinton world. Mook tried not to let the gossip distract him. If I think about this, I'm going to go crazy and jump out a window, he thought. But it was impossible to ignore. While some of her allies wanted her to get rid of Mook, Hillary was fed up with her consultants. Their direct contact with Hillary and Bill had slowly moved from frequent meetings to infrequent conference calls to almost nothing at all. With their own necks on the line, aides talked about what it would take to get Hillary closer in New Hampshire. The bigger the blowout, the more likely it was that heads would roll. They knew they needed divine intervention to win, but perhaps they could narrow the gap on their own. It was always considered a miracle to win, one of her advisors said. The conversations were more about what we could do to get ourselves in striking range. Still, she trudged around the small state to meet face-to-face with voters, tried to rally women to her cause, and generally pretended that she wasn't going to get her head handed to her. She was greeted with a paradox of sorts on the trail. She was getting traction with voters at her events. Her campaign headquarters was bustling. The volunteer organization across the state was strong. And yet, each night's polling data showed that none of it was making a whit of difference. I can't believe that these numbers are real, she said in one private moment, struggling to understand how she was trailing by so much, despite a feeling of energy at her events. I don't know what more we could do here. The answer was nothing. Her aides, as they would do in state after state, set expectations low for the media. In contrast to 2008, they poor-mouthed her chances consistently so that losses wouldn't look so bad and victories would seem much bigger. It was smart communication strategy, generally speaking, but it also framed Hillary in the role in which she was best liked, underdog. Her team tried to demonstrate that Hillary was pulling out all the stops to win every vote she could. A flood of her surrogates traveled to New Hampshire to make the case for her. Bill Clinton, Chelsea Clinton, writer and actress Lena Dunham, soccer legend Abby Wambach, and former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, several political luminaries from Sanders's home state of Vermont, more than a dozen members of Congress, and a variety of other marquee names. For Hillary, there was a certain catharsis in campaigning hard. If she was working, she wasn't wallowing. It was a trait that defined her for her loyalists for decades, the ability to grind it out every day, even when the odds were stacked high against her. To those around her, Hillary seemed happiest at off-the-record events with small groups. Compared with the big speeches and the crush of media attention, she liked the retail aspect of campaigning. Whatever the size of the event, Mook wanted to keep Hillary from visiting far-flung parts of the state. He and his team were trying to keep the margin closer by turning out supporters in vote-rich areas, which often meant having to talk Hillary and Bill out of traveling away from the population centers to convert Bernie fans. These decisions were guided by data analytics, which evaluated the likelihood that each voter would show up and back Hillary, and Mook's dogmatic belief that it was better to focus on turning out supporters than persuading a rival's voters to switch candidates. The smaller the town either Clinton appeared in, the farther they ventured into enemy territory, he thought, and the more it would be a waste of time and energy. This strategy would become a point of contention, with Bill in particular, who pushed to talk to rural voters. He had a better feel for people in hard-scrabble parts of the country than Hillary or Obama or really anyone else in the Democratic Party. He knew intuitively that Hillary had work to do outside the cities and suburbs in swing states. He had come from nothing, the man from hope, and had connected with working-class whites in 1992. Competing against Obama, Hillary had run up the score with that set. But now, With a choice between Bernie and Hillary, they were rejecting her. Bill wanted to get out of the bubble and shake hands. He'd been champing at the bit for quite a while. For most of 2015, he was Hillary's silent partner. He'd sit in on strategy meetings, pore over numbers, and offer his advice. But very intentionally and at the behest of Hillary's strategists, he held back from a public role at his wife's side. On one level, as a person familiar with his thinking said, Bill had overlearned the lessons of 2008. He felt he had been scapegoated for her primary loss back then because he had said impolitic and racially charged things on the campaign trail, and because he'd been overbearing at times with campaign aides. This time he wanted to be more measured. He would offer his opinions, press for information and justifications for campaign decisions, and share his thoughts with Hillary about what was being done well and what wasn't. Over time, he would become more repetitive and forceful with Mook. But in the early phases of the campaign, he minded his P's and Q's as best he could. Bill thought the campaign manager was a capable operative, but worried that the next-gen Mook was too invested in data to the exclusion of politics. Neither a traditional poll nor Mook's preferred analytics, voter behavior models based on surveys and demographic data, were as finely tuned as his own sense of political wins, Bill thought. They were an important part of a modern campaign, but not the only part. You couldn't place all of your eggs in the data polling basket, one of Bill's confidants said of his thinking. He had the ability to sort of figure out what's going on around him, to sort of take everyone's feedback and synthesize it and measure it along with his experience and then report back. Bill had done this thing twice. His handle on politics was as natural as Jimi Hendrix's feel for the guitar. Hillary couldn't grasp the sentiment of the electorate, the resentfulness white working and middle-class Americans felt watching the wealthy rebound quickly from the 2008 economic crisis while their families struggled through a slow recovery. Her team didn't really get it either. Beyond his own fear of being turned into a villain if Hillary lost, he knew she had to send the message to voters that she was doing this on her own merit, not as the anointed wife of a former president. The optics, her team thought, were crucial to avoiding the coronation narrative that had hurt her in the last campaign. But during the email summer, when Hillary was struggling to articulate a positive message, fellow Democrats were as eager for Bill to hit the trail as he was to emerge from the shadows of the campaign. He should have been a visible presence all along, columnist Brent Badowski wrote in an alarmed email to Podesta in September 2015. He is the great validator in American politics, the Babe Ruth of national politics when almost all other politicians, including Hillary, are widely distrusted. For the final 3 months of the year, Bill started to shake off cobwebs by raising money for the campaign. At those stops, he heard complaints about Hillary's staffing decisions, worries about Bernie's surge, and concerns about the email imbroglio. This litany of dissatisfaction reminded Bill of the 2008 campaign. Back then, his role was unclear, and he hadn't been utilized well. But now, he and his team were fully integrated into the strategy and tactics. Bill could get in touch with Brooklyn whenever he wanted to, but as he spent more time talking to donors, and eventually voters, around the country, his confidence in the campaign's management team dwindled. He wasn't impressed with the consultants who had failed to get his wife's economic message out of the gate, and he wasn't sold on Mook's capacity to run the operation after a nearly debilitating, whisker-thin win in Iowa. As he started campaigning for Hillary in New Hampshire in January 2016, Bill came to realize two things. First, He, Bill Clinton, of the silver tongue and golden touch, was a little rusty. He was too good not to know it himself. And second, he couldn't stand Bernie Sanders. You hear Bernie Sanders talk, he thought, and you'd never have thought George Bush ran this country for 8 years. To him, everything that's wrong with America, especially our social problems, are a direct result of whatever bad policy I set in motion. Bill understood that he'd be attacked in the campaign, and he was getting it from both sides. But that didn't mean he liked it. A week before he hit the trail, Donald Trump tweeted, "Hillary Clinton has announced that she is letting her husband out to campaign, but he's demonstrated a penchant for sexism. So inappropriate." Trump argued that Hillary's tolerance of Bill, after his affair with Monica Lewinsky and allegations of sexual misconduct against several other women, made her the candidate who was worse for women. Like Trump, Bill sometimes talked about women in less than respectful terms, but he tended to do so in private settings. In June 2014, as Bill was getting ready to speak at a Jefferson-Jackson dinner in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, his chief of staff, Tina Flournoy, mentioned to him and a small group of his aides that she was going to see the Rolling Stones in Europe. "Mick Jagger used to give my mother-in-law wet dreams," Bill offered. Trump was on his third marriage and had flaunted his own philandering, but there was no reason for Bill, a former president, to get in a fight with a Republican primary contestant. Bernie, on the other hand, was a different beast entirely. Because Hillary's opponent was targeting the party's progressive base, Bill had to suppress his instinct to hit back, to avoid sparking a pro-Bernie backlash among ultra-sensitive modern Democrats. It was frustrating. He was also learning that the laws of political thermodynamics had changed since he'd last campaigned for Hillary. Maybe it was an anomalous year, or maybe he just hadn't kept up with the times. But Bill was surprised by how little voters wanted to hear a politician's response to attack lines. In the old days, he'd get a chance to make his case. He understood that millennials blamed his 1994 crime bill for the mass incarceration that Hillary said she would put an end to. But he struggled to accept younger voters' reluctance to learn about the history of the law. It was in the cold New Hampshire winter that Bill started to come to terms with the degree to which the 2016 electorate was angry. Bill's time on the ground only encouraged his skepticism of Mook's reluctance to send him outside population centers. Having grown up in Arkansas, Bill understood that a major political player, a senator, a governor, or a former president, could bridge ideological divides by just showing up in small towns that never got much attention from elected leaders. He liked to go to small towns in northern New Hampshire, Appalachia, and rural Florida because he believed, from experience, that going to them and acknowledging he knew how they lived their lives and the way they made decisions put points on the board. Mook wanted Bill in places where the most Hillary-inclined voters would see him. That meant talking to white liberals and minorities in cities and their close-in suburbs. That was one fault line of a massive generational divide between Bill and Mook that separated old-time political hustling from modern data-driven vote collecting. Bill was like the old manager putting in a pinch hitter he believed would come through in the clutch, while the egg-headed general manager in the owner's box furiously dialed the dugout phone to let him know there was an 82% chance that the batter would make an out this time. It's not that Bill resisted data. He loved poring over political numbers. But he thought of it as both necessary and insufficient for understanding electoral politics. One longtime Bill confidant put the difference this way. Robbie was an expert in GOTV, get out the vote, data, and Bill came from a time when GOTV meant go on television. Not to get interviewed, but to get free media exposure that amplified his appearance in a small town and ensured everyone there knew he'd been by to check in. Trump's mastery of turning social media posts into 24-hour reporting on his campaign echoed Bill's instincts for getting free press. There was another aspect to Bill's desire to go into small towns. He believed, as did Hillary's top advisors, that it didn't make much sense for him to do national television interviews. There, he could be sandbagged by questions about whatever topic was Washington's obsession of the day and get sidetracked from the message he wanted to deliver. But Bill thought it was important to get earned, free, media exposure in smaller places. He'd rather go to a small town in a state and get the local newspaper to cover his speech and the questions he frequently took in rope-line interactions with voters and reporters. The model, which seemed to work well and which allowed him to pick and choose what he'd respond to, added to his confidence in his own old-school formula for politicking. Bill's frustration with Mook had grown during the lead-up to the Iowa caucuses and in the aftermath, when it was clear that the campaign manager's pet analytics models had overstated Hillary's margins. Even more, the close race had forced Bill to stare into the abyss of the possibility that Hillary would lose the first two states and never regain her footing. In New Hampshire, he pushed and pushed to get out of the southern population centers, Manchester and Nashua, and didn't get to do as much of that as he would have liked. "Honestly, I would love to have you go there, but I feel we've got to have you where the votes are," Mook told the former president. After having campaigned in New Hampshire throughout January, Bill knew just as well as Hillary did that she was going to lose the state. But he believed there was a chance to keep the margin under 10 points, which would provide a moral victory. Meanwhile, the numbers were moving in the opposite direction. Bill may have thought he or Hillary could persuade voters, but she would have needed a stronger vision to make the case. She had plans for every imaginable corner of public policy, but they were loosely strung together. There was no simple vision unifying them, no central defining promise of a Hillary presidency. Bernie, on the other hand, presented a very clear idea of where he wanted to take the country.